Nobody said yes. It's all right. Evening, my name's Matt. If we haven't met, I have the privilege of being minister here at Maybridge. We're an unusual church where there's whole sections of the church that nobody wants to sit and we don't know why. Anyway, we are continuing. We're doing over a few months the story of Joseph. It's a quarter of the book of Genesis, at the beginning of the Bible, is his story. And it's this big family epic, like The Godfather or The Sopranos or something. Joseph is one of a dozen brothers. He's his dad's favourite. And so they're jealous and they hate him. And he ends up as a slave in Egypt. And then he ends up in prison. But God has given him this strange gift for interpreting dreams. Now, in the ancient world, dreams were taken very seriously. People thought they meant something, but they didn't necessarily know what they meant, and they wanted to find out. And so while he's in prison, Joseph interprets the dreams of a couple of Pharaoh's staff. So Pharaoh, the ruler of Egypt, a couple of his staff find themselves in prison, and eventually word gets back to Pharaoh, who has had a dream of his own. And he's desperate for somebody to tell him what his dream means. He gets in all the experts. I'm not sure how you become a dream expert, but that's what he wants to do. No one can interpret this dream. And then finally, Joseph is brought in, and he interprets this dream. And he says the dream is basically about Egypt facing a famine, and it would be a really good idea to prepare for it, and maybe, nudge, nudge, hint, hint, put someone discerning in charge of admin. And Pharaoh is so blown away by this that he makes Joseph the prime minister on the spot. Like on the spot. It's very much not a democratic process in ancient Egypt. He literally comes out of prison and Pharaoh goes, yep, you'll run the country. Maybe we should do that. Maybe not. So we're going to look today at the moment this happens. It's basically the peak in Joseph's life. Things are great for him. Things are going well. There's been bad stuff before and it took a while to get here. Slavery, prison. But at this moment, life is going very well for him. And I'm glad to talk about this because if you're around church very much, you'll hear lots of messages on a Sunday about what to do when things are really hard. You will. And we need those messages. But what about when you're on top of the world? When everything is good, when you feel great, you're healthy, you've got enough money, etc. What does it mean to follow God when actually your circumstances are really good? So here we are. This is the later part of Genesis, chapter 41. So context, Joseph has just really impressed Pharaoh. He's interpreted this dream really well. And then this is what happens. And as we read this, just picture this and think about how great Joseph's life is while we're going along here, okay? Here we are. So Pharaoh asked them, "Can we find anyone like this man, one in whom is the Spirit of God?" Then Pharaoh said to Joseph, "Since God has made all this known to you, there is no one so discerning and wise as you. You shall be in charge of my palace, and all my people are to submit to your orders. Only with respect to the throne will I be greater than you." So Pharaoh said to Joseph, "I hereby put you in charge of the whole land of Egypt." Then Pharaoh took his signet ring from his finger and put it on Joseph's finger. He dressed him in robes of fine linen and put a gold chain around his neck. He had him ride in a chariot as his second in command, and people shouted before him, "Make way!" Thus he put him in charge of the whole of land of Egypt. Then Pharaoh said to Joseph, "I'm Pharaoh, but without your word, no one will lift hand or foot in all Egypt." Pharaoh gave Joseph the name Zaphnath-Paneah, prefer the name Joseph, and gave him Asenath, daughter of Potipherah, priest of On, to be his wife. And Joseph went throughout the land of Egypt. Joseph was 30 years old when he entered the service of Pharaoh, king of Egypt. And Joseph went out from Pharaoh's presence and traveled throughout Egypt. During the 7 years of abundance, the land produced plentifully. Joseph collected all the food produced in those 7 years of abundance in Egypt and stored it in the cities. In each city, he put the food grown in the fields surrounding it. Joseph stored up huge quantities of grain, like the sand of the sea. It was so much that he stopped keeping records because it was beyond measure. Before the years of famine came, two sons were born to Joseph by Asenath, daughter of Potipherah, priest of On. Joseph named his firstborn Manasseh and said, "It is because God has made me forget all my trouble and all my father's household." The second son he named Ephraim and said, it is because God has made me fruitful in the land of my suffering. The 7 years of abundance in Egypt came to an end, and the 7 years of famine began, just as Joseph had said. There was famine in all the other lands, but in the whole land of Egypt there was food. When all Egypt began to feel the famine, the people cried to Pharaoh for food. Then Pharaoh told all the Egyptians, go to Joseph and do what he tells you. When the famine had spread over the whole country, Joseph opened all the storehouses and sold grain to the Egyptians, for the famine was severe throughout Egypt. And all the world came to Egypt to buy grain from Joseph, because the famine was severe everywhere. So what happens to Joseph here? Well, first he gets all this affirmation from Pharaoh. Imagine if the king called a press conference just to present you to the nation and tell everyone how great you are. And then he's praised for his wisdom and his discernment. He's paraded on this chariot. He's sort of Pharaoh's wingman, and everybody can celebrate how amazing he is. And Pharaoh even calls Joseph one in whom is the Spirit of God. And the word for God is the Hebrew one, which means Joseph has impressed Pharaoh so much that Pharaoh is even acknowledging Joseph's God, which was very unusual for an Egyptian ruler. This is not a bad day, is it? I've had worse days than Joseph is having in this story. He's been a prisoner, now he's free, he can do what he likes, and plus everybody has to do what he says. He's got the best clothes, he gets loads of gold stuff, so now he's effectively rich. He's revered, the public bow down to him, he's placed in charge of a nation. He's also relatively young. He's 30 when this begins. He's given a wife by Pharaoh. I guess it's probably a wife he's quite pleased about. He's also blessed with children. He's successful at work and in storage. It goes very, very well. They can't even count the grain. So by any measure, Joseph is having a brilliant time, isn't he? This is a good time. He went from forgotten in prison to this basically overnight, like basically in an instant. And so what I want to do this evening, I've just got a few points on it, is to talk to us about how to live when life is great. How to live when life is great. For most of us, life has got ups and downs, hasn't it? Life's up and down. It's not all bad. It's not all good. And very often, I find, if you're a Christian, you know, God meets us when it's bad. Maybe we reach out to him. Maybe we learn something from our suffering. And there's loads of Christian messages and books and resources about what to do and how to live when things are bad. And there should be. There's lots in the Bible about that. We need that. But what about when things are really good? This is not spoken about enough. Because I think, actually, if you're a follower of Jesus, you are maybe at your most vulnerable to walking away from God or ignoring God when you're having a nice time. That might be when you're at your most vulnerable. What I mean is this, when you're happy and you're getting what you want in life, and maybe you've got enough money and you've got some nice things in the diary, that's probably the time when it's easiest to stop praying, stop thinking deeply, just sort of focus on yourself and forget the big picture of how temporary life is, how much we need God, and how actually in the end it's all completely empty without him. And it's not that we therefore invite pain and suffering. No, we don't do that. We don't go looking for bad stuff, of course. It's just that the times when we feel good can be deceptive and they can lead us away from engaging with what really matters. So here's three simple things I think we can draw from Joseph at a moment when he's loving life. Now, how do we live when life is great? And the first one, know God loves you always. Know God loves you always. Now, that might seem a bit obvious. If you know you've been a Christian for a while, that's obvious. And here's the thing, though. When things are going well, do you know that God loves you? When they're going well. Now, you might think, well, that's easy. Of course. Of course I think God loves me when my life's good. And that's the problem. Nice circumstances are not the way that you know God loves you. They're not. Nice circumstances are not the way that you know God loves you. God will give you lots of good things. Does it all the time. Anything good at all in your life is from him. But don't be deceived. Nice times come and go. Be wary of thinking on some level, God gave me that thing I really wanted. Life's good. Therefore he loves me. Therefore I will trust him. So easy to do. I think every Christian does this at some point. And it's a big problem. Think about it. Some people, you'll know some people, have amazingly nice lives, seemingly all the time. Other people have staggeringly hard lives all of the time. But God loves everybody the same. We have no clue of the hows and whys. It's above our pay grade. We cannot look at our circumstances or anyone else's and use that to measure the love of God. We can't do that. The way that we do know, the evidence that God loves us, is that he came into our world and was brutally nailed to a cross, and he let it happen on purpose to deal with our sin. That's how we know. That's love in action. And that happened whatever your week looks like, good or bad. That's how we know for sure that God loves us. But what we see in Joseph is a picture of God and us. In many ways, Joseph's life foreshadows what is going to happen later with Jesus. But also, because of Jesus, we end up incredibly being treated like Pharaoh is treated by Pharaoh in this chapter. When Joseph gets all this great stuff from Pharaoh, if you just sort of think about it for a moment, it's way over the top. It's way over the top. Literally, all Joseph has done is interpret one dream for Pharaoh and then suggest some arguably quite obvious administrative planning. What he gets in return is embarrassingly great. It's way overblown in relation to what he's actually done. I would imagine that there must have been some really clever, capable civil servants in Egypt who've done decades of great work for the country, and they've climbed the career ladder, and they're really miffed because this scruffy prisoner is the new prime minister. Out of nowhere. As Pharaoh is with Joseph, so God is like that with us. But more so, in the New Testament, in light of what Jesus has done, it says that God's people are a royal priesthood, that he puts a crown of glory on our heads, that he gives us an inheritance that can't perish or spoil or fade, that we get everything that Jesus deserves forever, eternally. And we did nothing to deserve or earn this. We didn't even interpret a dream. But we get all of it in Jesus. So let's see life in context. It's up and down, always will be. But in the good times, remember, God loves you. And even the best of days here and now is not as good as any day in the life to come that Jesus promises his people. Got to have that context. Second thing, on a sad note, looking backwards, deal with the past. This is a good thing to do when life's good. Joseph left his family home when he was 17. His brother sold him into slavery. He worked as a slave for years. Then he spent a load of time in prison. At the point when he has this great day where he's made prime minister, he has been away from the family that betrayed and rejected him for decades. I find that many people I have met have done an incredible job of overcoming the difficult family situation they grew up with. Personally, I'm very fortunate. I come from a very loving family, nothing much to complain about. But for many people, maybe for you, there's a lot of pain when you look back at childhood or even things that happened in young adulthood, things you don't want to think about. I also find that many people try to defeat the pain of what happened in the past by simply focusing on the good that's happening right now. Completely understandable. Maybe you build a respected career, or you have a great family yourself or something. But you can't run away from dealing with those past things forever. And you probably know that. After Joseph had been away from his family for years, he does eventually encounter his brothers again. We're going to see that in later weeks. And this time, the power's reversed. Now he's the prime minister of Egypt. And they're scared of meeting him. They're terrified. What will Joseph do? As it turns out, he's pleased to see them. There's tears, you know, he cries, but he forgives them. And it's a brilliant moment. But that can only happen if in the intervening time, in the time when his circumstances are good, and he's outwardly having a brilliant time, if he's done the hard work of forgiving his brothers for the evil that they did to him. And so one thing that is well worth doing while life is good is dealing with the past. We know that Joseph must have done this because of what he names his kids. One is called Manasseh, meaning God has made me forget. Now, you don't call your child God has made me forget if you've literally forgotten. What Joseph is saying is that although he can remember the events, he's forgotten in the sense that he's forgiven and he's moved on from that past. It doesn't shape him anymore. In his years away from his brothers, he's got to a place of peace. Whether or not he ever sees them again, and he, at this point he doesn't know if he will. The other child is called Ephraim, meaning fruitful or productive. Rather than be consumed with bitterness about the direction of his life, which his brother set in motion, he says, "It's because God has made me fruitful in the land of my suffering." It's not that he sees the Egypt thing as all good, wasn't, but he sees the good in it. It's become fruitful and productive, and so he's at peace. It's not just that Joseph has a nice life. Lots of people have a nice life, but are still controlled by painful things that happened in the past. Somewhere, somehow, Joseph has dealt with things in the right way. He's done the forgiveness that he needs to do. In the same way, when life is going well for us now, it's a good time to face the hard stuff from the past, because that's when you'll have the capacity and the energy to do it. It's a lot harder to face those things when you're sick, or you know, you've got money problems, or you hate your job. The time to do it, if you can, is when you're well and life is good and you've got the energy. And that's what Joseph did. What does that look like now? I think it starts with being honest. I've got to say, in the years I've been doing Christian work, I've heard plenty of people say things like, "Oh, my mum was awful to me," or "My dad was awful to me," or "Somebody was terrible at this point in my life, but I'm fine now. I don't care." And sometimes I'm not convinced. It does affect them. So don't deny the pain that's there. You know, we don't need to overcomplicate this. Talk to friends, pray about what you need to, think about who you need to forgive, see what God leads you into. You want to get to a place like Joseph, where you know full well what happened and you're not denying it, but you're able to forgive and live the life that you have, not the one that you wished that you had. The third and last thing, prepare for the future. Joseph has this amazing moment in his life when he interprets Pharaoh's dream, and it's weird and it's exciting. But his immediate advice to Pharaoh is to use the next 7 years, which were going to be abundant in terms of crops, to prepare for the 7 years afterwards, which would not be. In other words, Joseph uses the good times to steward well in preparation for the bad times. I love that the cool stuff, like interpreting dreams, is not detached from the sensible down-to-earth stuff, like preparing for hard times and looking after stuff well. If you're having a great time now, brilliant. But we all know life is not a continuous uphill thing. Joseph doesn't say, "I'll tell you what, you know, we're going to have 7 years of plenty. I'm now the prime minister, so let's just chill out about the future and enjoy ourselves." How many of today's politicians only do things that make them look good for the time that they're in office? Probably too many. But Joseph is thoughtful. He's proactive, and it's not only for his own benefit. His planning helps millions of people. He ends up being this great prime minister because he thinks long term about how to manage the nation and what it has. Now, I'm going to guess that most of us in this room are not responsible for a network of grain storage facilities in the Middle East, most likely. What we probably are responsible for is stewarding things, down-to-earth things like money and property and possessions. And so if you're living in a time of plenty, maybe things are going well for you right now. And with the current cost of living, it might not feel that way. This story gives us a great model. How proactive are you at managing what you have? For example, it's easy to spend more in those times you've got more money coming in, or you know, the day after payday. And of course, you know, we've got financial pressures from all angles. But when you think of the future, how can you steward what you have so that life is that bit more sustainable in the days to come? We're not talking about hoarding everything. That's not a good idea. But about thinking and planning and stewarding what you have well. Personally, for Naomi and I, that's my wife, we try to give a percentage of our income away every month. We believe that we need to do that, and that comes first. But if we can, we also put a certain amount into savings. Doesn't always happen, to be honest with you, but we try. And we could, you know, we could spend more money on nice stuff, but we try and save some so that when something comes up, some big thing, there's money there, just like Joseph's grain was there waiting for the time of famine. And I'm completely convinced that if you steward your stuff and your money in God's ways, he always provides what you actually need. Always. I've seen it too many times to think otherwise. Now, I know for us here and now, not all of us can save maybe anything or maybe not very much. But what we can do is make plans and be proactive and get help if we need it. And there are people at this church who would help. If you're sat there thinking, well, it sounds like a good idea, but I'm not savvy at organising myself, I'm not good with money, for example, speak to me. I can connect you with people who are really good at this sort of thing and would keep it confidential. And that might be for you a really great thing to do right now. So when everything is great, use the opportunity to get ready for the day when it isn't. Because as I said, things that seem spiritual and exciting, like interpreting dreams, are no more from God than wise, down-to-earth stewardship of the things that we've already got. So as I close, and I think I'm going to hand back in a minute, putting all this together, when life is good, know God loves you. Look back and deal with the past, look forward and prepare for the future, and do it all knowing that Jesus himself is the evidence that God loves you. He's the one who can bring healing to your pain from the past, steward for the future, and he's the one who secured your ultimate future to be blessed extravagantly by God, just like Joseph was by Pharaoh, but even better. Back to you, Jack.
Thank you, Matt. As we head into some more